Tonight on Circle A Radio, we are taking a look at the increased repression facing defense attorneys when it comes to defending unpopular clients as defined by the United States government. In February of this year, attorney Lynn Stewart was convicted on charges of aiding and abetting terrorists. Lynn Stewart is an attorney in New York and a member of the National Lawyers Guild who for years has argued cases on behalf of poor, mostly unknown clients. Known for defending many radicals, she was a strong presence in the Bronx Supreme Court. This current controversy she's involved in began over 12 years ago when she agreed to represent Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, a blind cleric who was convicted in 1993 in connection with the World Trade Center bombing. Lynn Stewart is now being persecuted for violating the special administrative measures which were imposed on her client, Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman. A statement she made to the press on behalf of her client is what has led her to be charged with lying to the government for violating conditions of the special administrative measures and providing material aid to terrorism. Lynn Stewart is 65 years old, a grandmother, and faces spending the rest of her life in prison. Some fear this ruling could send a strong message to defense lawyers about who you choose to defend. Her sentencing is scheduled for September 23, 2005. According to Michael Avery, president of the National Lawyers Guild, of which Lynn is a member, the National Lawyers Guild is strongly encouraging its own members and other defense lawyers to continue to proudly represent clients who are openly critical of government policies. Since Lynn Stewart's 2002 indictment, the NLG has assisted her in launching an educational campaign about the impact her indictment has on the Sixth Amendment right to an attorney. So stay tuned tonight for Circle A Radio's exclusive interview with attorney Lynn Stewart.
This is Lynn Stewart. I'm an attorney who has done criminal defense, meaning defending those persons accused of crimes by government for the last 30 years. About 2 years ago, I was selected out by then Attorney General Ashcroft to be prosecuted and persecuted as co-conspirator in a terrorism, aiding a terrorism plot, and was convicted of that last February, and am now waiting sentencing and an appeal. The development since the time of the verdict in late February, there was, first of all, it was a temporary suspension based on the mere fact of the conviction, so that at this time I'm no longer practicing law, which is probably a worse sentence than anything that a judge could give me, because I love this work and I've done it and I miss it very, very much. We're also, though, it does free me up to speak out about the case, to travel, to organize people. And so what we're doing is we are organizing mainly around the sentencing date, which is now late September, September 23rd, at which time the judge in the federal court here, his hands untied now by recent Supreme Court decisions, will fashion a sentence. He has a broad leeway, and he basically has only a guideline of what he thinks is the right thing to do. So he can sentence me from anywhere from probation or community service up to 30 years in prison. We're sure the government's going to be asking for years in prison, but we're hoping to get a lot of people to write a lot of letters and to convince him that it really is not the appropriate sentence. We're also, of course, doing motions, that is, at the close of the post-verdict period, before the sentence, the judge entertains legal questions, anything that may have come up, questions of the weight of the evidence. So my lawyers are working on those motions, and also those motions sort of look forward to the appeal, and the appeal will take place and will be a very substantial appeal because we think there are so many errors of law that happened in this case, not the least of which was, of course, that the government listened in on attorney-client privileged conversations in a jail in Minnesota between me and my client and then used those conversations as evidence against me. We're working hard. We're trying to keep a stiff upper lip, I guess is the expression. You know, keep on keeping on, I guess would be the expression we'd be more used to using.
So, Lynn, does the government actually have the authority to wiretap attorney-client communications?
The short answer is yes. Under the Patriot Act, they definitely have the right now. That was one of the new provisions. Formerly, they had it, but only under a tortured interpretation of foreign intelligence. And, of course, because my client, I guess, was a convicted Islamic fundamentalist, it thereby became foreign intelligence that they were listening to, notwithstanding the fact that he hasn't been to Egypt since the late 80s, and this was done in the year 2000. So one has to kind of raise their eyebrows, and this court that issued these foreign intelligence warrants, they've never turned one down. They've had applications from the FBI. The court itself is located in the Justice Department building, and they've never refused any warrant the FBI asked for. So that makes them somewhat questionable. And as I say, but now, and I always, when people say to me, well, you prosecuted under the Patriot Act, I say not directly, but indirectly, in that that was a law on the books at the time that I was arrested in the year 2002. And so it casts a halo effect over the whole case. In other words, things that were illegal in 2000 now, by dint of a new law, suddenly have a different look to them for a judge making a decision on whether a wiretap was legal or not. But it certainly goes to the heart of criminal defense work, because I think most people who have ever been accused of crime or had anybody they cared about accused of crime understand the importance of being able to level with the lawyer, tell the lawyer everything, and then come together to a reasoned decision about how to defend the case. Without that confidentiality, without that imposed upon privilege, the criminal defense changes its whole landscape. It just isn't possible to do it anymore.
This was back in 93 that Sheikh Omar was your client. Why do you feel like you were arrested in 2002?
He started being my client actually in 94. I then tried a 10-month case. This is for Omar Abdelrahman. He is a blind cleric who came to the United States mainly, and I always thought it's a sad thing that he was so mistaken that he thought he could basically come here and preach out against Zionism, preach out against the regime in Egypt, which is corrupt and which is totally autocratic by anyone's standards. And that there would be no repercussions. I don't think he ever understood who the United States government was and what role they played in the machinations of Zionism or of the Egyptian government. Suffice it to say that at the time that the World Trade Center was attacked the first time, his name was always mentioned in connection with it. His image was always shown in connection with that, even though he was never charged with that. He was never convicted of that. There were people who went to a mosque in which he had preached that were convicted, but there was no direct tie-in at all. I had the case where he was named as a member of a conspiracy, and there's no question that this particular conspiracy was framed in a way to be an attack upon New York City landmarks such as the UN and the tunnels, etc. But the fact of the matter is that it was cleverly engineered by a double agent, an Egyptian operative who was also working for the FBI. And he inveigled people, mainly people of very low resistance and willpower, to become part of a scheme. And he provided all the money, he provided the safe houses, he provided what was alleged to be explosives, although there were no explosives at all. And further, he inveigled the sheikh to give an opinion upon this. It was that opinion which he gave, which was innocuous at best, sort of delimiting and advising people to go slow, and this was not good for Islam, etc. That is what ultimately, I think, convicted him. But it was a case that was definitely engineered by this double agent, Imad Salem, who received $1 million for his work from the United States government, and who knows what from the Egyptian government. However, the sheikh was convicted. It was a 10-month trial. I was the lead counsel and chief counsel for the sheikh, and he was ultimately convicted of all charges and sentenced to life in prison plus 35 years. His appeals were exhausted sometime in the year 1998, but the legal team of myself, Ramsey Clark, and Abdin Jabara continued to represent him. The federal government, through the Bureau of Prisons, fashioned some very restrictive regulations specifically designed with him in mind. He was, to my mind, and I think to any other right-thinking person's mind, these restrictions were torture, or as close to torture as you can get without actually putting that on someone. They subjected him to an isolation so total that the only phone call he got was once a week to his lawyers and once a month to his family. And this was imposed upon a blind man who was not able to write nor receive mail, who was not able to read a book to relieve himself from this terrible isolation, who was not permitted to talk to his guards, even if he could, not speaking their language, and basically was held in this manner for year upon year. In the year 2000, on a regular prison visit, and we went maybe 2 to 3 times a year, and we being myself, Ramsey Clark, the ex-U.S. Attorney General, and Abdin Jabara, we would bring him messages from friends and supporters and family. This is what the government under this indictment has now called, quote, messages. We would also hear from him, read him newspapers, speak to him about current events and where the world was and how it was turning and turning out. And on one occasion in May of 2000, he asked me to make a press release, which I did. This was strictly speaking against these regulations, but we, and by that I mean the whole legal team, had always interpreted these SAMs, these regulations, as not to interfere with the legal work that had to be done. And by the legal work, I mean that which the law of ethics imposes upon us to vigorously represent a client. At any rate, I made a press release. The government did write me a letter, did require that I re-sign the affirmation saying that I wouldn't break these regulations, these SAMs, and I went back in to visit him. A year later, and this is now up to April of 2002, the FBI appeared at my home in the early morning and took me away in handcuffs based upon this press release to Reuters, which they claimed was part of materially aiding a terrorist organization in Egypt. Or we think in Egypt. We're not even sure of that because they never would designate where exactly or who exactly or why or why for. So the reason behind it, although I do think is something that we should look at, and it just seems to me that the Bush administration and through the Justice Department has basically created a climate of such terrible fear. And in order to keep this fear going for their own ends, which are scarcely innocent and mainly geared to enriching corporate America, they regularly have to trot some kind of terror out and say, see, we're protecting you from terrorism. Otherwise, it's hard to explain why Ashcroft came to New York that day of the indictment and went on the Letterman show, no less, to pound himself on the chest and tell them how he had protected the country from the terrorist grandmother, me. But at any rate, I basically think that that's what fueled this. They needed something. They had a lot of legislation, they had a lot of money, and they had very, very little to show for it 6 months after the World Trade Center. And so they dug up this old case and went ahead and prosecuted me, the interpreter, and the paralegal on the case.
And you're listening to Circle A Radio on KBOO 90.7 FM. You've been hearing an exclusive interview with Lynn Stewart, New York defense attorney, who is currently being charged with aiding and abetting terrorists. Stay tuned for more of this interview with Lynn Stewart on Circle A Radio.
Having another example of terror to track out, this is a specific example that's being given as a warning to defense lawyers. Do you know of other human rights defenders and lawyers that have faced any kind of similar repression at all?
Well, the one I'm most familiar with, and I would just remind you that during the first year of my prosecution at the ABA, not exactly a bulwark of radicalism, one of the persons who actually is now the head of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff, was speaking, and one of the people in support of me got up and said, why are you arresting lawyers, defense lawyers? What is that about? And he said, we're not arresting defense lawyers. We only arrested one. Well, you know, if you arrest one and make that one an example to all the rest, you don't really have to go into wholesale arrests, which might make you look bad. Well, because you effectively controlled the others by arresting the one lawyer, and I'm very clear that I am an example. I am used as an example to other lawyers about don't get into trouble like Lynn Stewart, representing one of these Muslims, these Islamists, these people the government has tagged as non-desirables or enemies of the state. I do think that there have been some excesses. I'm aware of a Muslim lawyer in Virginia who has had his bank accounts closed, who is basically being threatened with prosecution if he's not yet indicted. So, and he basically occupies some of the same territory, although his clientele was much more widespread. I basically had one client, and that was the Sheikh, for my Islamic involvement. But notwithstanding that, I do think the important thing is that by using me as this very public example, they sort of send a message to the defense bar that A, either will discourage good lawyers from taking on these cases because who needs trouble kind of theory, or B, will encourage those lawyers who will take on an unpopular anti-government client but will do the case in the way in which the government delineates. Either of these things really spells a death knell to the defense community, because we really we basically take cases as they knock on our doors. We don't make those kind of judgments, oh, this is too hot to handle, although we're permitted to make that judgment. And the second one is we certainly are not guided by our adversary as to how to present a case for a client. That was traditionally decided by the lawyer and the client, and it had not a thing to do with whether your adversary liked it, didn't like it, thought it was right, thought it was within the rules, whatever they thought. You did the case the way the client wanted it done. So that, to me, is the biggest inroad and what makes this case not a personal case alone, which of course it is to me, but also a case of an attack on the Bill of Rights itself.
Lynn, in researching your case, I learned that in the past you've defended people such as members of the Black Panther Party, Puerto Rican independence fighters. Do you feel like that past also has to do with why you have been targeted and prosecuted now?
It's interesting because I've increasingly gotten the sense that perhaps Ashcroft in his short-sighted neocon religious rightist way misapprehended who I was. I think he sort of thought I was like a leftover lefty standing out in the rain who somehow or other missed the bus, you know, that I had no support and I had outmoded ideas of the communism word, perhaps. I really don't know what was in his mind, but I think he certainly underestimated my will to resist him and to fight back. So I do think, though, that to a large part, someone said in a recent article that I have been a thorn in the government's side for a very long time. I have taken on cases of ex-Panthers, as you said, and Black Liberation Army and Weather Underground, United Freedom Front, May 19th Communist Organization, and in all of those cases have gotten results that were less than pleasing to the government. This is to say nothing of the thousands of cases that I did from the Black and the Latino communities here in New York, where, you know, people are not supposed to really get defended. They're supposed to get pled out, and they're supposed to be happy that they even have a lawyer that shows up in court. So I have certainly paid my dues in the sense of rendering service to those communities which do not usually get a high level of representation. I've also rendered service to the political communities who sometimes can be very unpopular, but undeservedly so in my view, and have had wonderful results in those cases. So definitely think there was more than just this case. There was an accompanying perception of my political outspokenness to accompany the prosecution. And I think they relied on that. So I think the combination of representing the people that the government saw as enemies of the state, plus representing those who traditionally do not get good representation, that combined effect pushed this prosecution forward. I don't think that the case was so strong, but they thought that having a, quote, convicted terrorist as a client, plus the added inducement of having the radical lawyer as a defendant would serve them in good stead. I hope we will ultimately prove them wrong.
Can you tell us about the judge in this case, especially since he's in charge of your sentence?
The judge's name is John G. Koetel. It's K-O-E-L-T-L. And his legal career spanned a beginning with as a Watergate prosecutor, which I had hoped might give him some notions of anti-authoritarianism, feeling that dealing with Nixon in that situation would show that the corruption of power, what it can do to people. He then went on to be a work in a large New York firm, and he worked there for many years, and then he got an appointment as a federal judge under Clinton, and he's a very, very brilliant man. He does not have a lot of the milk of human kindness, though. He is not very understanding, for example, during the trial of juror problems or juror interactions, the kind of things that, a humanist judge would have. He is a single man, he showed some courage when he, at first, the first go-around, he dismissed the indictment, saying that the law, while not unconstitutional, had been applied to me in an unconstitutional way. That is, that no lawyer could know what was aiding a terrorist and what was not aiding a terrorist by the government definition. However, after that, we don't know what happened, but certainly when the government came back with a new indictment based on the exact same facts but a slightly different construction, he did not blink an eye and allowed the prosecution to go forward. We certainly have gotten a sense during this 8-month trial that certainly is inclined to protect the status quo and the government and keep things moving in that direction, as opposed to being a pro-defendant and looking for things which would make a fairer trial. I think the best example of that is when the government came up with a way in which they wanted to introduce this videotape showing Osama bin Laden. And we, of course, fought against it because we felt, and rightly so, I think, that the prejudice of having Osama in a New York courtroom was not overcome by the minimal evidence it gave of the third defendant actually on the telephone with another person present with Osama. So, anyway, I'm not making this completely clear, but his allowance of that evidence to come into this trial showed that he really didn't see keeping it fair, keeping it without having overwhelming emotional appeals to the jury. So, taking all that into account, while we're not overly hopeful about our letter-writing campaign convincing him that he must, this is the judge that will sentence me on September 23rd, that he should really consider giving me a non-custodial sentence. Still in all, we do believe that he has it within him to do that. If he were to be convinced somehow that the playing field is no longer even, that the government has taken too big a bite, that there is a healthy concern among civil libertarians, among conscientious people, among lawyers, that there is too much of a tilt in the government direction. So, and that this would bring it back to a more normal place where people would be able to consider the ramifications of not following the government's, quote, orders in a different way. So, we are going to make an appeal to him. We have gotten some hundreds of letters so far. We hope by the time we go to sentencing, we'll have thousands. People can go to my website, www.lynnstewart, that's LYNNE, and then Stewart, STEWART, .org. And they can read the transcripts, which gives you an insight into the judge, but they can also see the template, the way in which we're asking that the letters be written. I don't mean the content of them, but where they should be addressed to. So that is what we're hoping for, that is what we're pointing to, that is what we're organizing around.
So Lynn, even if you were granted a non-custodial sentence, would you ever be able to practice law again?
No, I think that that would only be resolved by the winning of the appeal. At that point, if the charges were dismissed or dropped or the case was dismissed, then they would have to give me back my license. And we would probably have to fight it out with, quote, a disciplinary committee who might think I should not have broken these regulations. But it would be a very different kind of a struggle. This is an automatic disbarment. So that is what it would take. But we also have high hopes for an appeal, a group of three judges who would look at some of the excesses of this particular prosecution and rule on it.
Are you getting support from other lawyers?
The short answer to that is yes, I am getting support, but the longer answer is not as much as I had originally hoped for. I had thought really the profession would see this as an assault upon all of us and the way in which we practice, because the privilege is implicit in every case. This is what we do. We serve clients, and the privilege is important. But I think, as my husband Ralph likes to put it, those to whom they have always been, quote, privileged, they don't see it as quite so important. They're assuming the government would not do that to them, whereas the political and the downtrodden, of course, have always had this problem. So I think that the answer is that the bar, like every other facet of American society, is fragmented in the sense that there are some that are ultra-right, there are some that are ultra-left, and there are those in the middle. And right now we are doing as much as we can to encourage lawyers to see this not so much as a personal thing where they're coming out to, quote, support me, but where they're really coming out to support themselves, because that this will change the way in which law is practiced. And my own sense is if the government gets this kind of a foothold, they will exploit it. You know, it's a truism that the government is always flexing its muscle, trying to take a little bit more of the space that is supposed to be accorded to individuals and individual rights and the protection of them. So if they get through this without any real scarring to themselves, then they really will have won. So we have forming now, actually, a West Coast Lawyers Committee for the defense of Lynn Stewart. People can contact the National Lawyers Guild, and that would be Mary Jo Coonan, who is spearheading this, to rally lawyers, to get resolutions from bar associations, to make people understand why this is a terrible threat. And Mary Jo is joined by Susan Jordan and Steve Bingham and Mark Vanderhoff, all of whom have been out there as criminal defense lawyers, all of whom understand the threat implied by this prosecution. So we hope we will get more lawyers involved. We will get more bar associations involved.
You're listening to Circle A Radio on 90.7 KBOO FM. You've been listening to an exclusive interview with defense attorney Lynn Stewart. Stay tuned for more of that interview, as well as excerpts from a Prison Radio Project interview of Lynn Stewart by political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. Stay tuned to Circle A Radio.
You were interviewed recently by Mumia Abu-Jamal, and as you said before, you've defended a lot of different political prisoners, and now you're facing becoming a political prisoner yourself. I just was wondering if you could talk a minute about that connection and that kind of insight that you have through those experiences.
Certainly. Well, I can start by saying that I came of political age in Harlem. I went there as a sweet young thing from suburban New York to teach in an all-black high school. I can say very honestly I had no conception of the wrongs that have been done to black Americans. This was 1962, And, of course, it was an era in which we were able to go forward and try to redress some of those wrongs. And I was very deeply involved in a struggle for community control of the schools in New York City, and also anti-Vietnam War, and all the great causes of the 60s. So I definitely had implanted from those days, and also because of my ongoing activities. My husband of 40 years is African American. He's an activist, Ralph Pointer. And so I have always had a real alignment with the black community and doing the kind of work that I have done, of course, because the criminal law falls so unevenly on their shoulders. And I've spoken many times and have always remarked that although it may be new to white Americans to be living under a police state, there are certainly communities, black and Latino, Chicano communities, that have lived for many, many generations under a police state. So I think that when Mumia's case burst upon the scene, it was certainly for those of us who have labored in the criminal defense world, but moreover who have labored in the black righteousness defense, let us call it, it was certainly a call to come forward. And the tremendous unity that was shown around Mumia's case and the early part of the demonstrations has carried over, and I'm a true advocate of his. I think he is an innocent man who has been framed for reasons which we may not understand totally now, but which will become apparent. He was a victim of this mindless prosecutions that follow any kind of assault upon the police. We saw it earlier in Asada Shakur, Joanne Chesimard, who has recently been declared a domestic terrorist and a bounty of $1 million placed on her head, even though she's safe and living in Cuba, and I hope remains there for as long as she wants to remain there. I defended people who were accused of, as part of their federal indictment, of breaking her out of jail in New Jersey. And, of course, they asserted a defense of necessity, saying that they felt that, to some degree, she had to be broken out because otherwise the New Jersey State Police would kill her in the jail. Whatever the truth of that is or not, happily, we'll never find out. But clearly, Asada was framed. She was the one who was injured on the turnpike. It would have been impossible for her to fire the shots they claim she fired, but the temper of that time, the climate that exists in New Jersey, is one of the most powerful police states in the country. They have a tremendous number of police. The state police are very powerful, and I know because I've tried cop shooting cases over there where they had political people as defendants, and they brought them to and from the court in an armored car, and had snipers and sharpshooters on the roof so that the jury should know how dangerous these people were. So definitely the new ante in Asada's case has been raised. I hope and trust that she is in the safest place that she could be in this world at this time, and that is under the protection of the Cuban government. The fact that they're denoting her a domestic terrorist may have implications for those of us who have supported her, but you know this is part of the government's attempt to not allow us to say, I believe so-and-so is innocent. I think that person is wrongfully accused or convicted. They wish to celebrate. They wish to substitute a jury verdict for what we as human beings are allowed to assess as facts in a case. So as long as we're still able to say, I believe Asada Shakur was framed and she's not guilty. I believe that Mumia Abu-Jamal never got a fair trial and that he is an innocent man. As long as we're still able to say that, there is still hope out here. But I think we're going to have to start saying it louder and faster, or they are going to move more and more swiftly to silence our voices. So Mumia's case has always been part of that genre, the cop generated, they did it to me, even though we know in many of these instances the police basically assaulted people first and then later claimed the assault was made upon them. So Mumia's case, with all its errors, with judges who want to use the N-word and in referring to him, with witnesses who have since recanted, all of this means to me that there should be a new trial, there should be no question about a new trial, and he should possibly be vindicated without having to go through this tedium, endless nitpicking of appeals. And I say that as a lawyer, because I know that appeals, when you're caught up in appeals, it is not the same as fighting a case in front of a jury. So I have a tremendous affinity for him. I've been close to Pam Africa and Ramona Africa and the work they have done on his behalf, to Jeff Mackler, who not only heads the mobilization for Mumia, but also carries forth on the name of Lynn Stewart Defense Committee on the West Coast. So all of this interrelationship is part of it, but the real part of it is that his tremendous, and I say his, meaning Mumia Abu-Jamal's tremendous humanity, his intelligence, his insightfulness, is such a treasure, it should not be lost. And for that reason, I have championed his cause. I'll continue to do it as long as I have breath.
Up next, political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal interviews Lynn Stewart. This interview was produced and made possible by Noel Hanrahan of the Prison Radio Project.
Good afternoon, Mumia. What a pleasure this is.
It is a pleasure for us both, I hope.
I think so.
You have been, seems to me, singled out by the highest levels of the Justice Department for something that was not a crime, either now or even up until the signing of the infamous Patriot Act. Would you tell me what that was?
The Justice Department decided that things that I did as a lawyer are now to be outlawed, are now to be made into crimes in order to deter other lawyers from vigorously defending people. What I basically did was I issued a press release on behalf of my client. They said that this press release was a materially aiding a terrorist organization. And as they have accused so many others recently of that same crime, it seems to have no bounds whatsoever and can be used just about for anything.
So was this essentially illegal communication with your client?
Well, they had put on us a certain prison regulation. This is something Leonard Pelletier also suffers under in the federal system. It's called a special administrative measure, which lawyers and clients, not clients, but people that we represent, must sign on to say that you will not communicate with the press on behalf of your client, thus making it impossible for any First Amendment right to be protected. In other words, Sheikh Omar was entombed in Minnesota. He was not allowed to communicate with anyone but his lawyers and his wife in Egypt once a month. We, in contravention of these regulations, did make press releases on his behalf, but it is only now that that has become an indictable offense.
Isn't this kind of a on its face violation of the First Amendment?
Isn't it? I couldn't agree with you more. But, you know, they hide everything behind that cloak of security within the prison. And now, of course, security for the whole nation. They are going to be the protectors of Americans, they who have done so much to make it impossible to protect this nation.
So is it not also a fact that the U.S. government, through the Justice Department, monitored your communications with your client?
Yes, this press release was in May of 2000. For the next 6 months, they went back and forth about whether they would let me in the prison again. They finally said, oh, yes, you can go in the prison, and we signed on to enter the prison again. Only meanwhile, they had set up their cameras and tape recordings so that every conversation that I had with Sheikh Omar by telephone or in the prison were monitored. They heard every word that was said, in total derogation of the Sixth Amendment and, of course, the attorney-client privilege, which is part of that.
What it appears is that that's not just vanishing in federal prisons. It's vanishing in state prisons as well. Is it not so?
Well, I think so. You know, the states, they are not very slow to follow any leads that Big Brother gives them. So I think that most lawyers nowadays are sort of looking over their shoulders and thinking to themselves, who may be listening in? And if that doesn't create a chilling effect, as you well know, between the communication between attorney and client, we all assumed they might be listening, but not that they might use these things as a basis for further prosecution.
I would hope that you have heard from a number of your colleagues who are in stark protest against this latest governmental action.
The New York Times wrote a piece in their magazine called Left Behind. I think more to encourage people to leave me behind than to... But, of course, they've been saying the left has been dead in this country for many years. But to the contrary, we're alive and well, and I have gotten outstanding support, not only from the so-called radical or leftist lawyers of the National Lawyers Guild and other organizations, but from the everyday mainstream lawyers who understand that if we can't do this work, even within this racist criminal justice system, the way we have always done it, there will be no right to defend anymore. That right will just vanish. So I have gotten marvelous support. I once said that you have to die to find out how many people love you, but I'm getting it in this life.
Well, that's very good to know. I think that it should all, obviously, I think, be said that this is not kind of a lawyer's right. This is a right of the accused.
Absolutely. I once said to a...
It affects thousands, if not tens of thousands of people, and perhaps millions.
I said to a young documentary maker, you know, it's really not about whether or not this can happen to you, but it really is about, if it does happen to you, who are you going to call? Because there won't be a lawyer to call. The whole movement aspect of lawyering will disappear completely as they just knock us off one by one. And to me, that is the real essence of this work, is that we be permitted to lawyer in the way that we lawyered throughout the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and defend people such as yourself in these cases as political people, not just as defendant number 10872.
You have 1 minute left to talk.
Lynn Stewart, it has been my pleasure to talk to you and to have others share our conversation, other than the government, of course. And I support you. And I think what you're doing is quite wonderful.
And I may say, Mumia, I support you wholeheartedly. I'm sitting in front of a beautiful banner with African cloth saying, Free Mumia and all political prisoners. And it has been my work for 30 years, and it will always be my work.
We're going to have to create a new banner saying, Free Lynn Stewart.
Yes, I'm for that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All the best.
You too, dear. Bye-bye.
Bye.
J. check out lynnstewart.org for more information, LynnStewart.org. So Lynn, how are you doing? How are you holding up, and what kind of support are you asking for?
Well, I just came back from a wonderful tour of the Bay Area, including San Francisco and Oakland and Berkeley and Palo Alto and San Rafael and Marin County. So, you know, the support showed to me by everyone going to the universities, seeing these young people, some of whom came up to me and said, you know, because of you, I'm going to be a lawyer. Those kind of things just buoy one up, to use a trite expression, but a good one. They are the wind beneath my wings. They keep me flying. They keep me going. And also because I do consider the issues to be so important that the personal can kind of fade into the background a little, beside the fact that we really are experiencing a situation in which the entire Bill of Rights is being trampled, not just in my case, but in every case involving lawyers defending the rights of people who are really disempowered other than having a lawyer who will go to court and fight for them. And I speak of the people of Guantanamo. I speak of asbestos victims, people who are going bankrupt. In each of those instances, there has been an unprecedented attack on the notion of lawyers and lawyers lawyering. So I'm okay. I have my moments, of course. When I become somewhat dysfunctional and worry and think about going to prison and with a lot of distaste, because I've spent a lot of time in prisons and I know they're not nice places to be in. And as someone said to me at the recent From Attica to Abu Ghraib, that conference, they mentioned, Lynn, we don't need any more political prisoners. And I certainly agree with that. We have plenty to work on right now. But I also am not going to run away from this fight. I'm going to do everything I can to expose the government. This has been my life for my entire adult years, since I was that 22-year-old who went to Harlem and was really tabula rosa blank on everything. So I do believe in a protracted struggle, and I'm going to struggle on, and I just hope that I will get lots of people to join me and that we will ultimately win this thing. Well, I think the other important things are speaking out, are talking about the case to people that may not be familiar with it, mentioning why it is important, not just on a personal level, but also on a political level, that you know, this is a chance where we can stand up and be counted. The letter writing campaign, I think, is important because it's a personal involvement in the case. It's something that people can do that can help. And if we're victorious, everyone will share in that victory. If we are defeated, people will understand the power of the government and the way in which they can decree what the sentences will be, even though it's supposedly only within the discretion of the judge. We also ask people, of course, to contribute to help us out, and anybody that would like to do that, to the Lynn Stewart Defense Committee, as I'm no longer working, and so being able to go on speaking trips does help out. That also you can get from the lynnstewart.org. It has really a wealth of information, plus what you can do to help out. I want to say hi to my brother Donald and Andrea. May she have a speedy recovery. She just had some serious operation. And my two gorgeous nieces, Shana and Marley living up in the beautiful view of Mount Hood.
You've been listening to Circle A Radio. We'd like to thank Noelle Hanrahan of the Prison Radio Project for providing us with the Mumia Abu-Jamal and Lynn Stewart interview. Thank you, Lynn, for sharing your stories and your strength and courage. For more information about Lynn Stewart's case, check out lynnstewart.org. Circle A Radio airs the first and third Wednesday of every month at 6 p.m. here on 90.7 KBOO Community Radio. We'd love to hear your feedback. Drop us an email at info@circlearadio.org. Tune in June 1st for our next show, and thanks for listening.